Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. Today, we've reached episode 4 in our series about the ideas behind American presidential elections. And I'm going to be talking to Gary Gerstle about the election of 1896, the peak of democratic populism in the United States. How did the great populist William Jennings Bryan come so close to winning the White House? And why, ultimately, did he fail? Past, Present, Future is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books. Subscribe at a special rate by going to lrb.me/ppf. That's lrb.me/ppf. In today's episode, we're going to take the story forward to 1896, but we're going back to Chicago for another great, classic, legendary nominating convention. Again, this is a story of a candidate who is an outsider capturing the nomination at the convention. As with Lincoln, this is someone from Illinois. Lincoln moved to Illinois. This is someone who was born in Illinois but moved away. But there are lots of differences here. So in 1896, we're talking about the Democratic Party convention, not the Republican convention. And we're talking about someone who was even more of an outsider, I think a lot more of an outsider than Lincoln. William Jennings Bryan. He, like Lincoln, had briefly served in Congress, in his case from Nebraska. That's not the center of things. He was really young. He was so young he almost didn't qualify. So he was 36 years old, I think by far the youngest candidate for one of the major parties. But the key difference here, unlike Lincoln, is he captured the nomination at the convention because he was there in person. And he gave a speech. Lincoln gave many celebrated speeches, but not at the convention. Bryan gave a speech at the convention that remains one of the legendary pieces of oratory in American political history. Its reputation, like a lot of these things, is quite hard to recapture when you read it because a lot of it is a bit pedestrian. Some of it is quite technical, and we're going to have to get into the substance of what it was actually about. I think it remains legendary for its climax. So, Gary, do you want to just read a bit of it? And we'll get to the famous final paragraph.
There are two ideas of government. There are those who believe that if you will only legislate to make the well-to-do prosperous, their prosperity will somehow leak through on those below. The democratic idea, however, has been that if you legislate to make the masses prosperous, their prosperity will find its way up through every class which rests upon them.
So that's quite close to the end of the speech, and there is a repudiation, what came to be known as trickle-down, the idea that let the wealthy get wealthier and it'll feed its way down. This is a form of populism which is all about making sure that the people at the bottom are where you start. But it's also a speech, and this is the crucial part of it, about what was both a very technical issue and the source of this wave of populism. Gold versus silver. So we'll explain why that mattered so much. But it led to this final bit of the speech, which is what it remains known for. It's called the Cross of Gold speech. And the reason is because of this finale.
Before I read it, let me mention that Bryan imagined himself as a tribune for those on the bottom, both farmers and workers. As I read this last paragraph, keep that in mind. That was his ambition, but it was also problematic for reasons that will become clear from this last paragraph. You come to us and tell us that the great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city in the country. We will answer the elite's demand for a gold standard by saying to them, "You shall not press down on the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold."
And in the legend, though I believe this is what really happened, Brian is speaking in the convention hall to many thousands of people, and he ends this address with his arms outstretched, his head hanging down, a Christ-like figure. He crucifies himself in the imagery at the end of this speech, and there's a silence. I've read lots of descriptions of this, and there's a moment where he thinks, oh dear, I've overdone it. You know, there's something blasphemous about it, right? He's representing Christ on the stage. And then there is an explosion, what was known as a stampede. The crowd goes literally wild, and he gets the nomination almost by acclamation. It is an electrifying moment in American politics. The 36-year-old Nebraskan wins the nomination of the Democratic Party. But we need to explain why talking about the gold standard could have this effect on the convention and indeed on American politics. And this has a longish history, and it goes back a couple of decades at least. So to make sense of the power of this, in 1873, Congress passed what was called the Coinage Act, which effectively put the United States on a kind of gold standard. It tightened up the money supply. The effect of being on gold is on the whole deflationary rather than inflationary. The people who suffer when money is tight are debtors. It becomes harder and harder to service your debt. And the burden was thought to fall particularly heavily on American farmers. From 1873 to 1893 was a tough time economically in the United States. It was a long, not depression as such, although sometimes I think it's described as that. But certainly, times were tough. And then in 1893, there was a great crash, and times got a lot tougher. And the demand from the what came to be known as the populist side was to get off gold, or at least to allow silver as well as gold to back the currency, because silver is much more readily available. The point about the gold standard is there's not a lot of gold in the world. There's a lot more silver. Silver loosens up the money supply, and a looser money supply, which would allow, among other things, for inflation, would benefit the people who had been suffering. That's at least, I think, the broad outline of this, but it still doesn't quite capture the passions. Where does the passion for this come from? Silver became the rallying cry of this kind of politics. How did it happen?
I think the economic conditions that you refer to are crucial. In addition to the Specie Act of 1873, there's a decision to not pull greenbacks, what were called greenbacks, what today would be called paper dollar bills, out of circulation during the Civil War to pay for the extraordinary expenses. The government was issuing paper money like crazy. Inflation was running high. There was no tying of the issuing of greenbacks to any kind of specie. 1873, silver, which was taken out of circulation as a form of grounding paper money. And there's also a decision made to set a certain relationship between the value of greenbacks and the value of specie, in this case, gold. And so both these acts together have a severe deflationary effect. This is a moment of territorial expansion in the United States. Farmers are heading west. This is where Nebraska becomes so important. It's the Trans-Mississippi West. This is becoming the part of the wheat and corn bowl of America. This is also a moment of globalization in which countries around the world are becoming part of a world market, and there is competition now for American agricultural goods, especially from Ukraine, which is becoming the breadbasket of Europe. So on the one hand, there's deflationary pressure in the United States. On the other hand, there's competition to sell goods on the global market, which is also having the effect of depressing prices. And farmers are in an acquisition mode for land. It's after the Civil War. Peace has returned. They want to pursue their fortune. What is the triumph of the Civil War? It's in part the emancipation of the enslaved, but it's also a triumph for free labor. This is the chance for the Jeffersonian vision to be embodied, not just imagined, in the actual spread of householders across the land. So they're acquiring land during an inflationary period, and then these deflationary pressures You got to pay off the debt, and it's costing you much more by 1885 or 1890 to pay off a dollar of debt than it cost when you took out that mortgage in the first place. So this is part of the grievance of farmers, and there's all kinds of political activity preceding the People's Party, which has got to emerge in 1892. There's the Greenback Party. There's other parties. There's the Grange. There's all kinds of agricultural ferment going on in the countryside, political mobilization for 20 years, and tremendous anger and belief that this return to the gold standard is being orchestrated by Eastern financial elites in cahoots with one other Eastern-based set of interests, and those are the railroads. This is the moment when railroads are covering the country and grain is being transported all across the country. The railroads require a lot of investment. There are not that many of them. There is competition on the trunk lines, meaning the major lines going west to east. But railroads have spurs that go into the little towns all across rural America, and there they have a monopoly. And so they are gouging farmers in terms of transporting their grain or their corn from, say, Peoria to Chicago. And one of the great populist complaints was that it costs more in central Illinois. It's a couple hundred miles from Chicago. It costs more to transport their grain to Chicago than to transport their grain from Chicago to New York, where there was competition. So the railroads were gouging. They were seen as another Eastern interest. A lot of this is being tied together by the city of London, seen as the financial capital of the world, and a lot of investment from the city of London is going into railroads. They are, of course, supporting the gold standard. And so it does seem to an awful lot of farmers that Eastern bankers, Eastern railroads in cahoots with international finance are ruining them and making it impossible for them to live on the land. So the Jeffersonian dream that finally, as a result of the conclusion of the Civil War, seems to be in their grasp is now being stripped away from them in the most brutal kind of way. And a kind of desperation enters the countryside. Most of these farmers are Protestant. Many of them are evangelical Christians. When Brian is speaking to them about a cross of gold, part of what it meant to be an evangelical Christian is to have a personal relationship to Christ and a belief in a kind of salvation that would come your way. And so this language of redemption is very, very powerful in what is an intensely religious country, and the countryside is intensely and in places overwhelmingly Protestant. This is the vernacular language of politics in America. And if you want to be a popular politician, the ability to talk in Christian terms, not Christian isn't quite the right word because Catholics are not regarded as proper Christians by many in the United States, but the ability to talk this language of Protestantism, this language of evangelicalism, connects powerfully with people and offers a story of the fall and then redemption. And so Brian on his cross of gold, this is a language that the people in that convention hall understand and are ready to stampede about.
One thing that's sometimes said about it is that the symbolism here, as you described, we shall not allow mankind to be crucified on this cross of gold. So this is a very American message, but it's set in a global context. And if you read the pamphlets that were produced at this time, the villains, as you described, are on the East Coast of the United States, but the real villains are in the City of London. And to be honest, in a lot of that writing, they are clearly identified as Jews. So there is sometimes thought to be a kind of dog whistle anti-Semitism here. So we talked before about some of the conspiracy theories that you got, particularly on the nativist side, Whigs, Republicans, anti-Masonic, morphing into know-nothings and so on. That nativism, which is primarily anti-Catholic, these people did not believe that the Pope was at the heart of the conspiracy that was destroying the American farmer. They believed the Rothschilds were at the heart of the conspiracy destroying the American farmer. So there is another strand, and it comes and goes in American politics. It comes and goes, frankly, in lots of different places and the politics of lots of different democracies, which is anti-Semitic conspiracy theorizing. But this is one of the periods where it's strong, and it's strong on the Democratic side. And it comes and goes in the politics of the Democratic Party, anti-Semitism. We all know that. That's, I think, one of the things that's going on here. I'm not sure Brian himself, by the standards of the age, was particularly anti-Semitic, but I think he knew, after all, he's presenting himself as Christ, and we know who crucified Christ. He's also having to draw lines within the party because he's standing against the outgoing administration, the administration of Grover Cleveland, a Democratic president, president of the Democratic Party, who, though under pressure to side with silver, sticks with gold. So this is a real dividing line within the party. And then, as you say, the other line that he has to somehow draw and then straddle is he can't just win this election on the back of farmers. He needs the urban vote. And that final passage in the speech, it is astonishing. It is very powerful. The rhetoric here is much more powerful than the rest of the speech. This speech really builds to its climax. But he talks about, you know, what happens if you burn down the cities. And here he really does draw the line. He's on the side of the farmers. But that cannot be his platform because it's insufficient. So he's somehow got to square that circle. He's got to somehow get the workers, the urban workers of America, on his side too. And that's not nearly so straightforward, is it?
It's not straightforward at all. The People's Party, Brian, understand that to be successful, agrarianism is not enough. The United States is developing powerfully as an industrial nation. Its cities are becoming big. Its industries are competing on a world stage. The masses of people in these cities are enormous. Many of them are Catholic, Christian Orthodox, like Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, or Jewish. They are not Protestant. And the populists understand on a theoretical and conceptual level that the possibility of an alliance with workers exists because this is a very tough time for urban workers as well. The deflationary period of the late 19th century, their wages are not sufficient. The capitalism that is developing, that is fueling this development, is largely unregulated by any public set of institutions. And so you get what happens is what you get in an unregulated capitalist system: a cascade of booms and busts, periods of prosperity and hope followed by crushing depressions and unemployment. And in 1893, one of the worst depressions in American history hits. The Great Depression of the 1890s, it lasts for 4 long years. This is hitting workers in industrial areas particularly hard. There's a nationwide rail strike in which workers halt all rail traffic in the United States. There's a violent confrontation at Andrew Carnegie steel plants in Pittsburgh, where his workers get out guns to confront the Pinkertons, who Carnegie has hired to defend his capitalist property. Gunfire rings out. There is intense dissatisfaction. There's a sense that unless some kind of reform happens, the center cannot hold. And so there is a conceptual opportunity, a theoretical opportunity to bring workers and farmers together. But then you come across this language of the speech that I read earlier, which clearly talks about the superiority of the countryside to the city. And this surfaces again and again in populist language and oratory. And it goes back to Thomas Jefferson, this dream that what should America be? It should be a nation of independent farm owners, patriarchal families, living off the land, small businesses too, but this is not a society meant to be an urban industrial economy. And that suspicion of the cities lingers so powerfully in America and repeatedly frustrates well-meaning efforts on the part of populists to ally themselves with what is a burgeoning labor movement in the United States. And Brian is hopeful that he'll be able to do this in 1896. There's a logic for an alliance and a collective interest. They both see elites as being injurious to the welfare of the masses. But then you see language, as I read earlier, burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms and the grass will grow in the streets of every city in the country. This is about the superiority of the agrarian sector in American society. This is where the true America lies, and we must take care of agrarian America first. And if we want to understand the defeat of Bryan in 1896, he fails miserably in the northeast quadrant of the country from the Mississippi east all the way to the coast, Massachusetts.
This was the period that you just described of these extraordinarily violent strikes. I mean, something one notch below little moments of civil war, armed on both sides. People died. And some European Marxists looked at the United States in this period and thought, this is a great example of where capitalism leads. In the end, this is capitalism red in tooth and claw. And red in tooth and claw, the workers and the capitalists shoot each other. The problem with America was there was no, never mind no Marxist party, there was no organized movement for socialist representation, in the sense that there was a socialist standing in this presidential election. You know, there are always other candidates. Socialist Labour, he got 36,000 votes in an election where I think nearly 14 million people voted. It's completely negligible. So as it were, that field is there for Bryan. It's not like he's having to compete with socialist candidates. He ends up standing on what was called the Democratic Populist Silver Ticket, because there was a populist party that also nominated him. So unusually, he stood at the head of two parties. And some people think this was not helpful to him because it signaled he was not just a conventional candidate. It's sort of a bit like, I think, you know, Trump won the presidency in 2016 because he was the Republican candidate. If he had been the Republican candidate and something else, you know, if it had been the Republican MAGA ticket on the actual ticket, that might have frightened a few people off. Bryan had that to overcome too. After the convention, you then got, it's a very symbolic campaign, two completely different ways of running the campaign between Bryan and his Republican rival, William McKinley. Bryan conducted what was known as the whistle stop campaign. That is, he got on trains, the railroads, the evil railroads, and he traveled around the country and he spoke to people in person. There was no other way of mass communicating where you actually saw the candidate. So you could issue pamphlets, newspapers were part of American politics and they had been forever. But to actually communicate in person, this is like Burr's door-to-door campaigning in the age of the railway. So I guess Burr in 1800, you know, might have spoken to a couple of thousand people. Reputedly, William Jennings Bryan, over the course of the campaign for the general election, addressed 5 million people in an electorate of 14 million. He gave somewhere between 300 and 600 speeches, sometimes as many as 20 speeches in a day. Huge rallies, long speeches, festival, carnival atmosphere. He went out on the road and he spoke to as many people as he could. It has to be said, mainly in the agrarian parts of the country, but in the cities too. And McKinley, by contrast, conducted what was called the front porch campaign, where people had to come to him. So he gave speeches, but only if you came to where he was in Ohio. His campaign was managed for him by a man called Mark Hanna, who is sometimes thought to have invented many modern campaigning techniques. So Bryan was true to his populist principles in the way he campaigned. McKinley, who was standing on a gold platform. The Republicans adopted a gold plank, as they called it in their platform, explicitly. You know, we are on the side of sound money. Hanna also tried to defeat Bryan by using the fact that the Republicans were much better funded. So how did he do it?
Hanna raised a tremendous amount of money. He is often thought of being the prototype for the modern campaign manager of the 20th and 21st centuries. There were precedents for Hanna in localities and states. One of the best examples of that is Tammany Hall in New York, a pattern of inventing techniques of reaching the people, mobilizing them, getting them out to vote. This goes back all the way to Burr in 1800, who began this process, and it expands from what Burr's project was in New York City, and then it expands to states by 1896. It was now a nationally coordinated campaign, and it also reflects the nature of politicking in America and what is required. If we think, what does it take to elect a president, we tend to think of a national election. and you can just appeal to the nation. But in fact, that is not true. One has to appeal to every state in the nation because one has to win the requisite number of electoral votes, and electoral votes are being cast by individual states. And so if you're going to have a national campaign, it means you have to have as many campaigns as there are states in the country, and you must have a general staff in place in each state who is going to look after the welfare of your party in that state. And Hannah becomes the coordinator of all these state campaigns across the country to a degree that had never been accomplished before, and he coordinates them, and he has the money to do it because he's raising money from corporate sponsors, elite groups in American society who are terrified by the populist challenge, terrified by the intensity and the violence of the strikes. And so he's able to use the fear that the populists and the labor movement have generated to get corporate America to open their coffers, his party, in a way that has never been done before. And it's the combination of the ability to raise so much money and to funnel it through all these different political parties at the state level that signifies a tremendous advance in the sophistication of electioneering. It also points to a perpetual problem in American politics, which is the money required to operate this labor-intensive electoral system is extraordinary. If your party has the support of wealthy elites, they can supply the money. What if your party does not have the support of wealthy elites? Then you have to do what Brian does, which is to get on a train and get out there and go to as many states as you can. He's estimated to have traveled 18,000 miles by train, a whistle-stop tour, talking endlessly. You try and match the power that wealth confers on certain elites with amassing an army of organizers, a incredible, intense schedule of speeches that will serve to mobilize the masses and get people to volunteer, take people to the polls, get them out to vote. You try and generate support by getting out there and going into the field and bringing all kinds of Americans into the project of making your man president of the United States. And this is divergence that occurs between those who have elite money and those who don't. And we're going to see other elections where this discrepancy comes into play.
And in this case, as in many other cases, money won. McKinley won the election. One of the things that Hannah did was the age before mass electronic communication of any kind. So he had to print pamphlets. He had to produce bits of paper. He had to get the message out in the most traditional ways, by the post and so on. But he realized, to use a very contemporary term, that he could use social influencers. If you could identify the people who had some kind of standing or kudos in a very small setting, those people would be the best way of communicating your message. He particularly targeted foremen in factories and working places. If you could find the person whom 10 people maybe didn't particularly respect in the sense that the message would be, this person believes X, therefore that's a trustworthy guy. It's more, this person believes X. Ooh, maybe he's saying something about what would happen to us if we vote Y. It was a mixture of fear and influence, and it was very, very effective. I mean, this was campaigning in the age where most of it still had to be face-to-face in some way or another. And it was an extraordinary contrast between Brian on his train speaking to these huge crowds and Hannah, much more micro. And there have been other genius micro campaigners on the Republican side. One thinks of Karl Rove, for instance, finding that the best way of communicating this is really at the smallest possible scale. And it worked. And it produced an electoral map, if you look at it. It's one of the most distinctive features of American politics, which is very familiar, red and blue states, but it's the exact mirror of the map now. So the blue states are now the red states, and the red states are now the blue states. It's blue in the middle and in the south, and it's the coastal regions that are red. It's the classic American electoral map, but by late 20th century standards, it's in reverse. So we're going to have to talk about how that happened. This wasn't just an election about gold and silver. One of the other things that McKinley did, with, I think, Hannah's encouragement, was to go back to the issue of tariffs. Tariffs remains crucial here. Brian was brought up in a household by a father who worshipped Andrew Jackson and Stephen Douglas. He thought of himself as a Jacksonian in politics. There he was in his speech. He complained about this international conspiracy of gold and of bankers and of foreign competition forcing down grain prices. McKinley said, well, given how much people are suffering, I would rather have tariffs to keep this foreign competition out. Bryan was still, in a sense, trapped by that democratic tradition that was deeply suspicious for agrarian reasons of tariffs. And the tariff message was quite effective in this campaign.
There was the McKinley tariff passed before McKinley became president. It was passed in 1890, and it upped the average duty on goods coming into the United States from 40 to 50% of the value. So a very, very steep tariff. And McKinley, running for president in 1896, is able to convince millions of industrial workers that their interests lay with Republicans, because he would keep the tariff walls high. And keeping the tariff walls high meant that employers could pay workers in America a higher wage than their equivalents were getting in Europe and elsewhere. And to reduce the tariff was going to be to let in foreign products, foreign goods that were going to undercut American manufacturers, throw workers out of work, undercut their wages. This is a replay of what had become a century-long struggle in America, with the Democrats, with their agrarian base, wanting low tariffs because they are still imagining themselves as an exporting economy. They need the world. And the Republicans believing in their program of manufacturers, in some ways it goes back to Hamilton. These are no longer infant industries, but they still need protection. And the Republicans are able to make the argument that protection will work not just for the industrialists, but it will work for the workers as well. And so in addition to the cleverness of Hannah in terms of getting the right influencers in the right place, they have a program that in the context of the 1890s seems to many industrial workers valid. And you combine that with the suspicion of rural America and its intense evangelical Protestantism and their suspicion of other faiths that so many industrial workers in urban areas have. This becomes a successful sales pitch and dooms the Democrats and Bryan in 1896. One of the ironies of this election is that many of the proposals that came out of the populists that Bryan adopted and made part of the Democratic Party are going to become signature features of Democratic Party legislation over the next 30, 40 years, whether it's an income tax or a system for managing agriculture in the interests of farmers or forms of Social Security or regulating or nationalizing the railroads. The first paragraph of Bryan's speech that we read, which talks about using government to help the masses, is going to be a message that will become central to the Democratic Party, its agrarian and its urban wings in the 20th century. But in 1896, the way of bringing those constituencies together around a program of positive government, there's not a way to do it.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It was one of the ironies of this campaign. It both looked back and looked forward. So it looked back to a world that we talked about before, where the South had had a competitive advantage on the international grain markets, or in that case, the cotton markets. And that had gone by this point. So the international market was meant to be the friend, but it clearly was the enemy. And that does, I think, provide one explanation for where the conspiracy theorizing came from. Must be the Bank of England, the Rothschilds, the City of London, they're all in cahoots against us. But this campaign also looked forward. It looked forward in various ways to certain kinds of social reforms, as you described them. One other minor party I want to mention, the Prohibition Party in this campaign got a bit more than 1% of the vote, so it's not by any means a huge vote share. It was a lot more than the Socialists. Brian was committed to prohibition. It was a big part of the politics of this era. And of course, a generation or so later, for a brief period, that also was something that was enacted. Prohibition was part of a package that included revivalist religion, populism, the Silverite stance. But it's a deeply moral politics. It's a politics of moral injunction. How strong was it on this side, and how popular was it? It was a strain of populism, and there were divisions within the prohibition parties. Some people just wanted to be single-issue parties, prohibition. Others said to be a prohibition party with any chance of getting any traction, we have to bring on board other progressive issues, and one of which was women's suffrage. So the prohibition parties, some of their supporters, were also some of the strongest champions of votes for women. Is it a significant strand in the politics of this period?
It's a very significant strand, and it speaks to the importance that many of those involved in politics attach to issues of morality. And at bottom, I think this commitment to a moral polity rests in classical Republican thought that in order for liberty to flourish, people need to be virtuous. And virtue springs from different foundations. Part of virtue springs from economic independence, hence the importance of the agrarian ideal and owning your own land. But virtue also springs from proper morality and proper discipline and godliness and aspiring to the good life. And this is a very important element of American politics. The connection to the suffrage issue is really interesting because women are often in the forefront of prohibition agitation. And there's a critique of male behavior that emerges from the ranks of women that they feel very keenly and very deeply. And the story that's told is of a man getting his wages at the end of a week and going to a pub with his mates and blowing it all there and not bringing the money home to the wife and children. How to correct this form of male corruption and male vice? Well, empower women to have a voice in politics. And arguments develop among many, many women, and this becomes an argument for suffrage, not just for radical feminists, but for women who have quite traditional conceptions of womanhood. Womanhood needs a greater voice in politics so as to civilize the men. And one way that women can civilize the men is to enact laws that prevent them from being dissolute and engaging in various vices, drinking and gambling, that are going to strip families of the moral integrity and discipline they need to be citizens in a proper republic. So if we understand that it's not just drink, but it's about rendering the polity whole and virtuous, then we can see the ability of prohibition to extend its influence into other realms. And of course, once women begin to imagine a role for themselves in politics, they're not going to limit it to drink. They're going to seek influence in other areas where they feel that men have come up short.
One of the differences between American presidential politics now and then is now, usually, you get one shot, and if you lose, your party will look for someone else next time round. Wasn't always true. Adlai Stevenson's, for instance, he ran twice. Brian was going to go on and run another two times. So this did not end his career by any means. He went all in this campaign. He, in a sense, captured the party, wrested it away from its elites. The populist challenge was successful within the Democratic Party, but it was defeated at the general election. And it wasn't a blowout, but it was a decisive defeat. He hit the wall of money, and money overwhelmed him. But the Democratic Party did not turn away from Bryan. Bryan is a real power broker in Democratic politics from the age of 36 for another nearly 20 years. But silver died as an issue. And as America came out of its Great Depression and a new wave of prosperity started to emerge, the passion behind silverism fell away. And Bryan needed something else to hitch his wagon to. And he found it in what happened in the McKinley presidency. Bryan was a pretty shrewd, smart politician, and he was much more adaptable, I think, than people believed. In 1896, America embarked on a new period in its history, semi-imperial, or maybe fully imperial, phase of expansion, beginning with the Spanish-American War. To start with, Bryan was an enthusiast for the Spanish-American War because he believed in emancipation from tyranny, a good Jeffersonian ideal. He believed in revolution, and emancipating Cuba was a noble ideal from the imperial, backward-looking Spanish. But it quickly morphed into a war of acquisition, including, crucially, of the Philippines. And at that point, Bryan became a campaigner against war, an anti-war campaigner, and against American imperial expansion. That then becomes the new theme, the new dividing line in American politics.
It becomes one of the dividing lines in American politics. The United States was verging on world power status in the 1890s, first decade of the 20th century, and it is beginning to compare itself to its rivals, Britain, France, Belgium, Germany, Japan. And it seems that what these industrial powerhouses have in common is desire to bestride the world stage, in part to secure additional markets for goods, for exports, and in part because overseas triumphs and overseas possessions are seen as signaling greatness. And also, each of these countries is being hit by serious economic divisions, class divisions, the rise of Marxism, the rise of socialism, a sense that capitalism may not work and it may be superseded by the socialization of all property. If you're not going to pay poor people more, how do you convince them to get on the bandwagon? And one of the ways you convince them is to participate in an experiment in national glory. So national unity, national patriotism, national greatness becomes a cause that people of all classes can affiliate with. And it's hoped in these various places, including in the United States, that this will put salve on some of these deep social wounds, give people something to feel proud of that doesn't require the kind of compromise between capital and labor, rich and poor, that to the elites in this country seems very dangerous. So if we see external expansion as being, in the eyes of people like Bryan, a way for getting away from the social question, then we can begin to understand why he becomes such an ardent critic of overseas expansion. It's a ruse. It's going to distract America from its true interests. Plus, America was the first anti-colonial nation, the first to free itself from colonial control, and it had an obligation to continue to spread that message to other people struggling to emerge from colonial subjugation. He was supportive of the war in Cuba as long as it seemed like this was going to be about emancipation and freeing the Cubans to be free and independent of Spain. But then very quickly, America wants to impose its will on Cuba and strip it functionally of its independence. He becomes a fierce critic of that. He becomes a fierce critic of America's possession, taking possession of the Philippines, a Spanish colony in the Pacific. And he says this will corrupt American democracy. This will distract people from the urgent social questions at home, and it will betray the inheritance of the country. So he becomes anti-imperialist. He becomes a critic of war as an instrument of geopolitics, and this will persist through World War I. Among his supporters, he attracts not just pacifists and not just Democrats. And here we get into the other element of the populist agitation, which is less attractive. And that is, what will it mean to acquire Puerto Ricans, Filipinos in the American nation? What about if they migrate to the U.S.? They're Catholics, they're people of color, and they're cheap, and they will undercut the workers of America, and they may undercut what it is that makes America special, which is that America is meant to be, at the end of the day, a Protestant nation. So some of the anti-imperialist agitation is about suspicion of foreigners who are coming dangerously close to being incorporated into the United States. And this is a country in which the race issue internally is not resolved, in which cities are filling up with immigrants who are mostly not Protestant. And so there's a portion of the anti-imperialist surge whose rallying cry is America for Americans. So it's not about democracy, but about exclusion and purity.
In the episode that we recorded about Andrew Jackson, you said we have to be careful about using the word populist. It can have a different meaning in the United States than it does in non-US context. It has a particular connotation now in the third decade of the 21st century, pejorative primarily. In this period, however, populist was the word. Capital P populism was in the name of a party, and then it was in the name of the platform on which Bryan stood. It is sometimes thought to have peaked in 1896. This was maybe the closest, perhaps before Donald Trump, to a populist being elected president of the United States. And we're going to talk next time about another P word, progressivism, which is something very different and becomes the wave of American politics within barely more than a decade. Do you see this as a peak of populism? Is 1896, because there was a 20-year wave building up to that election, and the passions are ferocious. That speech probably doesn't capture it. People sometimes say you had to be there. I would love to have been there when Bryan gave that speech. I think if there was one political speech I could have attended, just because I've read quite a lot about it, the stampede, the shrieking, the hysteria, an audience of many thousands of people losing their minds. It's very hard to recapture it on the page. The passion was wild. Did it break in 1896? And actually, should we understand this as really depending, as so often in politics, on underlying economic conditions? There was a 20-year wave because there was essentially a 20-year depression. And when the depression lifted, the populist wave broke. Or should we think that a lot of what we've been talking about here, those strands of populism that stretch all the way back to Jackson, even to Jefferson, and stretch all the way forward into the 20th century, this is much more of a continuous story. It's not the story of a wave that broke, but it's a story of a strand of American politics that is ever present.
The latter. People's Party peaks. Populism as a distinct political party peaks in 1896. It will never again exercise the influence it had in American politics between 1892 and 1896. But the populist surge lives on, and populist sentiment lives on in very powerful ways. I think we have to ask, what is the function of third parties in the United States? It is almost impossible for a third party to displace one of the existing two parties. It has not happened in America since the Republican Party did it in the 1850s. I have to be careful what I say, but right now I cannot imagine a third party, even given the circumstances into which the current Republican Party has fallen. I still have trouble imagining another party arising to supplant it. In the structure of American politics, it's almost impossible for that to happen. And if we ask what then is to be expected of a third party, it's not to displace one of the dominant two parties, because that can almost never happen. It's to exert a kind of ideological and political influence on the dominant two parties, so it bends them, at least partially, to the will of that insurgent movement. And if we examine populism not as a party, but as having a certain will and having a certain direction of travel and having a certain slate of reforms, those reforms are to a remarkable degree going to be implemented in American society between 1910 and 1940. They're going to be part of progressivism. They're going to be part of the New Deal. And if we see populism from that point of view, we have to grant that it had enormous influence on the shape of American politics. And part of that influence was grounded in popular organizations that began long before the People's Party. Self-organization, self-mobilization of farmers, other groups in American society, that self-mobilization is going to begin to extend to urban groups as well. The ideas of the populace live on in these mobilized groups, and these mobilized groups are going to become part of the Democratic Party, and during the Progressive Era, part of the Republican Party as well. The influence lives on, and populism is going to define, to a large extent, both progressivism and elements of the New Deal. So seen from that perspective, this explosion in the 1890s is going to redirect the path that American politics is following for the next half century.
Do sign up now for our free fortnightly newsletter. You just need to click on the link in the show description, and coming soon will be an edition accompanying the first four episodes in this series, including today's. You can also follow us on Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it, at PPF Ideas. Next in this series, I'm going to be talking to Gary Gerstel about the election of 1912, when the Republican Party split, allowing Woodrow Wilson to win the White House. How did that election, and the role played in it by Theodore Roosevelt in particular, change the American party system and American politics for good? This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.